Chapter 21. Geoffrey was still shaking, still doing his best not to think through the consequences of what had just transpired, as he tossed his soiled garments into the wash and changed into fresh clothes. His instinct was to blame Hector. But even if Hector was responsible for him committing the violent act, he could not be held accountable for the intervention. That was the point of the mechanism. It was oblivious to persuasion, supremely immune to influence. Nor was it done with him. It might take hours, it might take days, but he would be called to account by shrinks and practice, subjected to exhaustive profiling, not just to make sure he was suitably repentant, but to satisfy the mechanism's human consultants that the impulse had been an aberration, not the manifestation of some deeper psychological malaise that required further surgical intervention. He was in trouble, unquestionably. But he still had every reason to distrust the cousins, every reason to think that they would not waste a moment in erasing Eunice's legacy. Still in his room, with the door ajar, he used Truro's secure quangle path to Ching Tiamat. "There's been a development," Geoffrey said, when the smooth-faced merman had assumed form.
"You're referring to the disposal plans?"
Truro, who was half-submerged in pastel blue lather, gave a vigorous, blubbery nod.
"I assumed that would have come to your attention as well. There's no timescale for the operation, but we can safely assume it will be sooner rather than later, now that permission has been granted."
"There's something else. I've just done something impetuous. Or stupid." Geoffrey lowered his gaze, unable to look at the pan directly. "I confronted the cousins."
"Perfectly understandable, given the circumstances."
"And I tried hitting one of them."
"Ah,"
Truro said, after a moment's reflection.
"I see. And this act, was it?"
"The mechanism intervened."
"Oof."
He blinked his large, dark seal eyes in sympathy.
"Painful, I'll warrant, and doubtless fairly humiliating as well.
I've had better mornings."
"Any, history of this kind of thing?"
"I don't routinely go around trying to hit people, no." But he had to think carefully. "Got into a fight when I was a teenager over a card game, or a girl, both maybe. That was the last time. Before that, it was just the usual stuff we do in childhood so that we understand how things work."
"Then I doubt there'll be any lasting complications. We're animals at the core, even after the enhancements. The mechanism doesn't expect sainthood. All the same, it does complicate things now."
"That's what I was thinking."
"Usual protocol in this situation would be a period of probationary restraint, I think they call it. Denial of org and Jing rights, restricted freedom of movement and so forth, until a team of experts decides you aren't a permanent menace to society and can be allowed to get on with your life without further enhancement. With a caution flag appended to your behavioral file, of course. The next time you're involved in anything similar, the mechanism won't hesitate to assume you're the initiating party, and it may dial up its response accordingly."
No bones, the mechanism would kill if killing prevented the taking of an innocent life. Just because it didn't happen very often didn't mean that the threat was absent. Geoffrey's crime put him a long way down the spectrum from the sort of offender likely to merit that kind of intervention. But still, just being on the same spectrum, he wasn't too thrilled about that. "What do I do?"
"We need to get you to Tiamat before probationary restraint kicks in. A human has to be involved in that process. Probably someone with a dozen or so pending cases already in their work file. That means we may have an hour or two."
"Once I'm in Tiamat, how does that help?"
"We have ways and means. But you need to get to us, Geoffrey. We can't come to you now."
He looked around the little room, underfurnished and impersonal like a hotel he'd just checked into. He realized he wouldn't miss it if he never saw it again. Other than a few knick-knacks, there was nothing of him here. I'll see what I can do.
Make haste, Truro said. And speed. Haste and speed. Very good things right now.
Jemai was swimming lengths, cutting through the water like a swordfish, all glossy sleekness and speed. She made this basically inhuman activity appear not only workable, but the one viable solution to the problem of moving. I thought we might take a flight around the area, he said vaguely, when she paused for breath at one end of the pool, elbows on the side. Is there stuff you need to deal with, to do with Memphis? Nothing that can't wait. You all right, Jeffrey? She was looking at his trousers and shirt. Why have you changed? He offered a shrug. Felt like it. She shrugged in return, appearing to accept this explanation. Mind if I do a few more lengths? He nodded at the clear blue horizon. It was untrammeled by even the wispiest of clouds, the merest hint of the weather system they'd flown through around Kigali. There's a front coming in. I thought we'd try and duck around it. A front? Really? Revised weather schedule, he offered lamely. And this can't wait?
No, he said,
trusting that she'd understand him, read the message in his eyes that he couldn't say aloud. No, it can't. Okay, then I guess it's time to get out of the water. She changed quickly, hair still frizzy from being towel-dried when she rejoined him. Jeffrey was anxious, wondering when the iron clamp of the probationary restraint was going to slam down on him. What's up? She asked him, sotto voce, as they headed towards the parked AirPods. Something. To do with me being here? It's not you. He was answering in the same undertone, but I need you with me. Is this about the job?
Might be.
He beckoned the closest AirPod to open itself. Jemai climbed in confidently, Jeffrey right behind her. It was only as he entered the cool of the passenger compartment that he realized how much he'd been sweating. It was drying on him, cold prickling his forehead. Manual, he voked, and waited for the controls to slide out of their hidden ports, unfolding and assembling with cunning speed into his waiting grasp. A moment passed, then another. His hands were still clutching air. Manual, Jeffrey repeated. I'm afraid that manual flight authority is not available, the AirPod said, with maddening pleasantness. Please give a destination or vector.
Jemai glanced at Jeffrey.
You're locked out? Take me to Tiamat Aqualogy, he said. That destination is not recognized, the AirPod replied. Please restate.
Take me to the sea over the Somali Basin.
Please be more specific.
Head due east.
I'm afraid that vector is not acceptable.
You're not allowed to take me east.
I'm not permitted to accept any destinations or vectors that would involve flight over open water.
Jeffrey shook his head, confounded.
Who puts this restriction on you? I'm afraid I'm not permitted.
Never mind.
Jeffrey clenched his fists, giving up on the AirPod. He cracked the canopy, letting out the bubble of cool, scented air, letting the African heat back in. Fucking Lucas and Hector. Jemai pushed herself out. They'll have locked them all down, won't they?
All the AirPods, Jeffrey said. Not the Cessna.
It was parked at the end of the row of flying machines, already turned around, ready for taxi.
Engine start,
Jeffrey voked before they'd even got there. The prop began to turn, the hydrogen electric engine almost silent save for a rising locust hum that quickly passed into ultrasound. That was good, at least. He didn't think that the cousins had the means to block his control of the Cessna, but there was little he'd put past them now. If you knew they couldn't stop the Cessna, Jemai said, why didn't we... The hydrogen feed line was unplugged, lying on the ground next to the plane. Jeffrey had connected the line when he'd arrived, still focused enough to do that, but he had no idea when the cousins had come along to remove it. Watch the prop wash. Jeffrey opened the door and allowed Jemai to climb under the shade of the wing into the co-pilot's position. He removed the chocks and joined her in the cockpit. Skipping the flight readiness checks, he released the brakes and revved the engine to taxi power. The Cessna began to roll, bumping over dirt and wheel ruts on its way to the takeoff strip. Only now did Jeffrey check the fuel gauge. Lower than he'd have wished, but not empty. He thought there was enough to make it to Tiamat.
We're running away, aren't we?
Jemai said, fiddling with her seat buckle. That's basically the deal here, right?
Jeffrey lined up the plane for takeoff. I screwed up. I hit Hector.
She said it back to him as if she might have misheard.
You hit Hector?
Tried, before the mech intervened, and dropped a boulder on my skull.
Oh boy,
she was grinning, caught somewhere between delight and horror. Way to go with the conflict resolution, Jeffrey.
I'm at war with my family. Escalation was the logical next step.
Yeah, you know, I think that's what they call pretaliation.
She was shaking her head.
And now what?
He pushed the throttle to take off power. The Cessna surged forward, the ride bumpy at first until sheer speed smoothed out the undulations in the ground.
We're on our way to Tiamat.
Too cheap to send their own plane? They can't now I've got myself in trouble with the mechanism. They won't be rushing into a direct standoff with the family either.
They were at takeoff speed. He rotated and took them into the air.
Something about you has changed,
Jemai said.
I'm not sure it's good, but something's definitely changed. You used to be boring.
And now? Jeffrey made a steep left turn, bringing them back over the white and blue A of the household.
Less so.
Jemai loosened her seat buckle.
So, how far to the coast?
About 500 kilometers.
He eyed the fuel gauge again, wondering if he was being optimistic. Call it 2 hours of flight time. And then we still have to get out to Tiamat. He patted the console. But we're good.
We'd be better off walking. She's an old machine, but that's good. Cousins can't touch old machines.
Maybe it isn't the cousins we should be worrying about, Jemai said.
Especially if you've just pissed off the mechanism.
Jeffrey smiled. The household wheeled below. Two figures were standing by one of the walls, looking up at him with hands visoring their eyes. He waggled the wings and aimed for the ocean. Not that it was ever going to be that simple, of course. They had not been in the air for more than 10 minutes when two AirPods closed in, one on each side, pincering the Cessna, with only a wing's width to spare. Jeffrey took his eyes off the horizon just long enough to confirm that it was the cousins. They were flying in the same two machines that had been parked on the ground near Memphis's body. Hector to starboard, Lucas to port.
I think they want to talk, Jemai said. Someone keeps trying to push a figment through.
They can fuck off. We're long past the point of recent discussion. He had been rebuffing figment requests since he had taunted the cousins from the air. There was nothing he wanted to hear from them now.
They're getting pretty close. I know AirPods can't collide with each other, but...
She left the sentence hanging.
Don't worry, Jeffrey said. If they do anything that even looks as if it's an attempt to force us down, suddenly I'm not going to be the main thing on the mechanism's mind.
That'll be a great consolation as they're scooping me off the ground.
We're not going to crash.
Anyway, this should be a walk in the park for you, the queen of high-risk data recovery. You laugh in the face of explosives and nerve gas.
Jeffrey, a voice said, cutting through his thoughts like an icebreaker. I'm sorry to use this channel, but you've left me with no option. Get out of my skull, Lucas.
Jemai looked at him in dismay, not hearing the cousin.
I would, Lucas said, if I thought you'd accede to communication on a more orthodox channel.
What's happening?
Jemai asked. Lucas has found a way into my head, Jeffrey said, having to shout to drown out the voice that was still droning on between his ears. Don't know how.
He didn't.
Even Memphis couldn't reach him when he didn't want to be reached, and there was no reason to suppose that the cousins had any secret voodoo that offered them a backdoor into Jeffrey's mind. They'd have used it already if that was the case when they were trying to contact him about Memphis being killed.
It's simple enough, Lucas was saying. You fled the scene of a high-level intervention before a risk assessment team had the chance to interview you. The mechanism takes a fairly dim view of that. They'd shut you down again if there wasn't a risk of endangering both you and your hostage.
She's not my hostage, Jeffrey said. Tell that to the authorities, cousin. The mech's given me direct access privilege because I'm kin and I might be able to talk you out of making this worse for yourself.
Well, you can tell them you tried. Now fuck off. Jeffrey, listen to me. We understand that this has been a difficult emotional time for you, but don't compound matters by behaving rashly. Don't blame me, Lucas. You started this by sending me to the moon. There are things best left in the past, Lucas said. If you cared about this family and its obligations, you'd understand that. There are millions of people who depend on us, who depend on stability. Our stocks barely faltered, Lucas. Other than us, no one gives a shit about Eunice. Which is exactly why none of this is worth what you're doing. She's history, Jeffrey, a ghost. Leave it to the mechanism. This isn't your problem anymore.
He hadn't expected Lucas to take him at his word. But after a few moments, the cousin's AirPods peeled away, leaving the Cessna alone in the sky. Jeffrey was surprised at how shaken that left him feeling. He twisted around in his seat to watch the two vehicles dwindling aft.
Lucas is gone, he said softly.
There was nothing they could do, Jemai said.
You said it yourself.
Knocking us out of the sky was never an option.
But eventually, the mechanism came as he had always known it would. They were over the ocean by then, and the fuel warning had sounded three times. Two civil administration vehicles approached, official blue and whites garbed in org-generated EAF and AU insignia, vectoring out to sea from Nairobi, or maybe Mombasa. Bigger and faster than the cousin's AirPods, blunt-hulled, stub-winged, barnacled with duct fans, rhino-ugly with angular, chiseled hull plates and the horn-like black protuberances of weapons systems. Quite something in this day and age to be confronted with such an overt display of peacekeeping authority. Jeffrey couldn't remember the last time he'd seen anything like it. On Earth, at least.
All this for little old me, he felt like asking. Really, you shouldn't have.
Maybe quitting the day job was a mistake, Jemai said.
They think you're my hostage, Jeffrey said. At least, that's the stance they've decided to take. So I wouldn't worry if I were you. They're not going to say or do anything that might put you in danger.
Until they dig around in my background and decide, hey, maybe his Nigerian ex-girlfriend might be an accomplice after all.
They're still not going to do anything stupid. I haven't committed any crime. I just fled the scene of one I didn't succeed in committing.
Tell that to the judge.
She was looking through the windows, jerkily alternating between starboard and port, like someone following a vigorous tennis match.
I've seen some mean machinery in my time, Jeffrey, even driven some of it.
They're designed to intimidate, which is why we won't be intimidated.
The enforcement vehicles, insignia hovering around them like bright neon banners caught in their slipstreams, were much bigger than the Cessna. But that worked to Jeffrey's advantage, too. The pilots would look at this little white toy of an aeroplane and see something preposterously old and fragile, not realizing that the ancient airframe was in fact much tougher than it looked.
Jeffrey Akinya,
a voice said, cutting through everything just as Lucas's had done.
This is the civil administration. Please return to your place of origin.
Sorry, no can do, Jeffrey said.
An intervention was necessary to prevent the completion of a violent act, Jeffrey.
He was being spoken to like a child, with great forbearance.
Under such circumstances, a process of review must always take place. Submit yourself to probationary restraint, and you have nothing to fear. I urge you to turn around now.
The voice was deep, male, unmistakably Tanzanian.
You can't stop me, can you? There's nothing in the world you can do to make me alter my course.
The vehicles came closer. They were as big as houses, armored like bunkers. This kind of military spec enforcement technology was like a coelacanth. It had no business still existing in the present. Yet Jeffrey now realized it had been there all along, a covert part of his world, tucked decently out of sight until he transgressed against the mechanism.
This is your last warning, the voice said. Turn around now.
That was when the fuel ran out. Jeffrey had never ditched an aircraft before, never even considered that he might one day face the possibility of ditching. Ditching was what happened when things went wrong, when things were miscalculated. Yet here he was, ditching the Cessna. He came in at just above stall speed, full flaps, and flared steeply at the last moment. The wheels bit water. The aircraft slowed quickly, nose pitching into the sea, and then leaned slowly to starboard until the wingtip was submerged. The engine had stopped. The Cessna rocked in the green swell of the Indian Ocean, silent, save for an occasional creak from the airframe, as if it had always been waiting for its time as a boat.
"Life jacket under your seat," Jeffrey said. The sea air tickled his nose. "We have to get out. She's not built for floating."
Jemai extracted her life jacket.
"Meaning we swim for it?"
"Not much choice, I'm afraid."
"There are sharks in these waters."
He nodded. "We should be all right. The mechanism's probably already clearing any large predators from the area, or euthanizing those that don't take the hint."
"You hope?"
"Right now, being eaten is the least of our worries." The administration vehicles loitered overhead. That was good, in one sense, because it meant they wouldn't have to wait long for rescue. Mechanism or not, Jeffrey didn't relish the prospect of spending hours in the ocean. Bad in another sense, though, because once Jeffrey and Jemai were floating, it wouldn't take the authorities long to work out a way of scooping them into custody. But the Cessna was definitely sinking. Water had been lapping in from the moment they ditched, splashing through the door seals and engine openings. With their life jackets on, Jeffrey and Jemai climbed onto the sloping surface of one wing, but that would buy them minutes, no more. Jemai was sitting on the inclined wing, her feet dangling over the edge. Jeffrey stood, hands on hips, knees bent for balance, anxiously surveying the horizon. He'd been able to see land from the air, but not now they were down.
"Whatever happens," Jemai said, "I'm sorry about your plane."
"Me too."
There was a clunk from under the fuselage, softened by suspension as if the submerged undercarriage had just touched dry land. With a lurch, the Cessna righted itself, the wing becoming horizontal once more. Jeffrey staggered, nearly losing his footing. Jemai reached out and grabbed his ankle and nearly lost her own purchase in the process. Water sluiced away in rivulets. With the smoothness of a rising elevator, the Cessna emerged from the sea.
"The fuck?"
Jemai said. Jeffrey offered her a shrug of incomprehension. There was a black road under the wheels. The black road was rising, forcing itself into daylight. Ocean was sluicing off the road as well, down its broad, curving flanks. Jeffrey turned slowly around, half knowing what he'd see. In the opposite direction, the road ran into a sheer-sided black tower, its rounded, tapering form rising to a hammerhead lookout deck.
"We're on a submarine," Jeffrey said. He had to say it twice just to convince himself. "We're on a submarine!"
Jemai dropped from the wing onto the slick, rubber-treaded deck.
"And this is good or bad?"
"I think it's good, for now."
The submersible was from Tiamat. He knew this even before a door opened in the base of the tower and an exoed merperson came striding out. He squinted against a sudden, salty lash of sea spray. It was Mira Gilbert. Behind her were three other exo-clad merpeople.
"Hello, lubbers," she said, beckoning. "Come inside. We'll secure the plane, then get underway."
Jeffrey climbed off the wing, touched a hand to the side of the engine cowling, reassuring it that he would be back. In truth, he had little idea what was going to happen next. His ordered plans, such as they had been, were in tatters. He had done a shameful thing, then fled the scene of a crime. He had refused to submit to mech authority, and now he was surrendering himself to people he barely knew, let alone trusted. It wasn't too late. The administration vehicles were still loitering. He could still take his chances with the ocean, let them swoop him into their custody. For a moment, caught between branching possibilities, two versions of his life peeling away from each other like aircraft contrails, he was paralyzed.
"We're waiting, Mr. Akinya,"
Mira Gilbert said.
"You don't need to be a part of this," he told Jemai. "You could still..."
"Fuck that," she said, shooting a dismissive glance at the hovering machines.
"Sooner take my chances with the aquatics if it's all right with you. If you're smart, you'll do the same."
She was right, of course. He'd committed to this path from the moment he'd tried flying the AirPod. No point in second-guessing himself now. So they went inside, and the administration vehicles were still loitering when the submarine filled its tanks and slipped under the waves. The craft turned out to be the Alexander Nevsky, one of Tiamat's small fleet of subsurface freighters. The Nevsky's function was to carry or haul cargoes that were too heavy, bulky, or hazardous for the elegant, hyper-efficient, wind-driven cyberclippers that now moved 9/10 of the world's global freight. The Nevsky was a good 150 years old, rehabilitated from some dark former career as a nuclear deterrent vessel. Now the only atomic technology aboard was its engine. Missile bays had been gutted of their terrible secrets and turned into storage holds. Behind it came a ponderous string of cargo drogues, hulled with sharkskin polymer to minimize drag, each as large as the submarine itself. The Nevsky demanded little in the way of a crew, judging by the exceedingly sparse onboard provisions for cabin space. In fact, it probably ran most of its duties entirely unmanned, save for any passengers who might be along for the ride. "How did you get here so quickly?" Geoffrey asked Mira Gilbert when they were underway again, and after he had asked for the 20th reassurance that the Cessna was being taken care of. "The Nevsky was already operating in the area," the merwoman said. "Routine cargo run. I podded aboard when it looked like we'd be able to make a rendezvous." Geoffrey and Jemai had been given dry clothes, towels, and brimful mugs of salty sea-green chai. They were underwater now, travelling at maximum subsurface cruise speed. But there was no way to tell that from inside the Nevsky. No aug reach, no means of opening a window through the iron dermis of its hull. "I don't know how much Truro told you," Geoffrey said, "but I'm in a lot of trouble with the mechanism. I don't think they're going to let me get away with it this easily."
"We can hold them off for the time being," Mira Gilbert said. "Technically, you trespassed on initiative property, you see."
"By ditching my plane?"
Gilbert nodded enthusiastically. "Over our submarine."
"I didn't know it was there," Geoffrey said in benign exasperation. "How can that possibly count as trespass?"
"It's all for the best. You're in our immediate jurisdiction now, which means we can activate various quasi-legal stalling measures."
Geoffrey shivered. It was cold inside the Nevsky, even with the warm clothes they'd been given. "Won't that get you into a standoff with the mechanism?"
"You came to us, not the other way around," Gilbert said. "That changes the landscape. There are now procedures which can be brought into play."
"Such as?" Jemai asked.
"If Geoffrey applies for Tiamat citizenship, the mech has to wait until we've completed our own battery of psych assessments, which, within reason, could take just about as long as we like."
"And then what, you hand me back anyway?"
"We'll cross that bridge later. For now, let's get started on the citizenship application."
She smiled at his hesitation.
"Just a formality. You're not signing over your immortal soul to Neptune and his watery minions."
"What do I have to do?"
She voked text into the air. "Just read these words and we're good to go."